from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, the NRA affiliate in Massachusetts asks its members to monitor student protesters.
A lot of people talk about, like, why people should be allowed to have guns because it's a right. With the sign, I was emphasizing that, like, everyone has the right to be alive and that should be more important than owning a gun.
Also today, a new movie about the continuing mysteries surrounding the late Ted Kennedy and Chappaquiddick.
Moses had a temper. Peter betrayed Jesus. I have Chappaquiddick.
Yeah, Moses had a temper, but he never left a girl at the bottom of the Red Sea.
Plus, a look at Shakespeare in the time of the Me Too movement.
Which would you rather? That the most just law now took your brother's life, or to redeem him, give up your body to such sweet uncleanness?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. There's a new controversy today after yesterday's massive student walkouts across the country to remember the victims of the Parkland, Florida school shooting. Here in Boston, hundreds of students and their supporters marched to the State House calling for tougher gun laws.
Enough is enough! Enough is enough! Enough is enough!
But before the walkouts, the National Rifle Association's affiliate in the state, the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts, asked its members to video and document the student marches. It said that it would like the footage to protect against what the league says is an anti-civil rights agenda. WBUR's Max Larkin is following this story, and he joins us now. Hi there, Max.
Hi, Deb.
So exactly what did the Gun Owners Action League ask its members to do?
Yeah, it was right as the walkouts were taking place. They asked members who are parents to, quote, go to school and document the walkout, what's being said, what the signs say, what teachers slash faculty slash guests are saying, and it said video is by far the best. And then they were told to email whatever they found to Goal's legal team. So the thought was just to capture anything that seemed to infringe on Americans' Second Amendment rights.
And what does the Gun Owners Action League say about why they sent out this email to members?
Well, Jim Wallace, who runs the organization, says they sent the email in response to complaints from parents that students who were in favor of those Second Amendment rights were being bullied on campus. Wallace said what he called social bigotry is a fact of life for gun owners in the state, and that he remembers his daughter being kind of shouted down by teachers, showed Bowling for Columbine, the anti-gun Michael Moore movie, back when she was a young advocate for gun rights. He says the videotape campaign was just a way of making sure that that wasn't going on at this week's rallies.
You don't see us out there threatening people that if they don't come to see our way, we're going to protest at your house or blow up your Twitter feeds or, you know, try to get people to stop doing business with you. We don't do any of that. All of that comes from the other side.
I think it's worth noting that the email doesn't actually mention bullying. It says, as you noted in the lead, that parents should be on the lookout for any sign of a, quote, anti-civil rights agenda. But Wallace said that any video and photos that they did receive were never intended to be put up on social media to shame parents or even young people. He said they would be for internal use only.
But wasn't there a tweet this morning from Goal featuring a photo from a protest?
Yeah, so there was a picture, even as I was speaking to Jim Wallace, showing a large walkout at Acton-Boxborough High School this morning. And by 10 a.m., there was a picture on Goal's Twitter feed showing parents at the protest holding anti-NRA signs. And the tweet ended with a little sarcastic line, "No agenda here." But it turned out that image didn't come from a Goal member. It came from State Senator Jamie Eldridge's Twitter feed. Eldridge is one of the most liberal lawmakers in the state, and he's the one who certainly most forcibly condemned the original Goal email. Wallace, who runs Goal, said this was a sign of a kind of double standard at work.
I'm really kind of shocked at the response that we're getting, that somehow what we're doing is bad or evil or because there's kids involved, and we're not the ones trying to use them for social media.
Wallace said he was not aware of any footage sent in by goal members so far in response to the email, but he said he'd have to check in again at the end of the week to see if that came in. There was, it's worth noting, a tweet from a former goal member saying that as of today with the picture campaign, that he was canceling his goal membership and he wanted the organization to let parents parent.
Any reaction from students, Max?
I spoke to the student organizers in Acton, Boxborough. They weren't aware of that original email. They said they had an impressive turnout this morning, 1,000, maybe 1,500 participants from inside the school and the surrounding community. 17-year-old Acton, Boxborough senior Rachel Pryke helped lead that effort. She said they were really trying to honor victims, but she admitted they were also pushing for action. But none of that, she says, was an attempt to demonize individual gun owners. So she felt like the original email from Goal felt like a misunderstanding of what students were up to this week.
It doesn't make me nervous, but it definitely makes me sad. It's not us trying to target them. We're saying that this group as a collective has the power to change these laws and safe lives, and they aren't, and that needs to change.
And Pryke added that there were definitely students at Acton Boxborough who didn't agree with what the walkout students were up to, maybe who supported gun rights, but she said they had the opportunity to decline to walk out. They did discuss things, and finally a lot of them said, listen, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to get into a big argument.
Is there common ground between Goal and the student protesters on the proposed legislative efforts at all, do you think, Max?
Not really. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be more starkly opposed in some ways. The students yesterday at the State House were embracing two big causes when it comes to guns. They'd like to see the state's assault weapons ban survive a court challenge. Goal is the organization that is mounting that court challenge, so there's not a lot of common ground there. And then they also want to see a new bill that would create an extreme risk protective order passed that would allow the state to take guns away from people who are deemed able to or liable to harm themselves or others. Jim Wallace told me that he considers that bill cruel, saying it would be a way to take legally owned firearms away from people who might be suffering from depression or other ordinary kind of commonplace mental illness.
Okay. WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Deb.
A group of prominent Boston leaders is getting involved in the debate over the name of Yawkey Way. A letter signed by business and nonprofit leaders and by Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley is urging city leaders not to change the name of Yawkey Way. And the letter accuses the Red Sox of making the renaming of a street into a racial issue. That letter was presented to the Boston panel responsible for changing street names today, and it was presented by Reverend Ray Hammond, who joins us in studio to talk about this. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Deb.
Also on the line with us is ESPN's Howard Bryant. He's author of Shutout, a story of race and baseball in Boston. Thanks for being with us, Howard.
Thank you.
So, Reverend Hammond, let's start with you. Why did you present this letter to the Public Improvement Commission in Boston today?
My concern was really twofold, that they certainly gave fairly benign reasons for offering to suggest that the name be changed. But if you then looked at the national coverage, invariably it came down to two things. One, the allegation, often said, never proven, that Tom Yawkey had called Jackie Robinson the N-word, and the fact that the Red Sox were last in integrating the team. That last one is an indisputable fact. That's true, it's painful, it's sad. And as I've said, Boston and the Red Sox have to own that, no question about it. And it's particularly painful in the light of so many other things that have gone on in Boston, from busing to the difficulties in economic inequality, you name it. That said, there's just no evidence for the notion that Tom Yawkey was a virulent racist who would call Jackie Robinson the term, or that there was absolutely deliberate foot dragging and no efforts whatsoever to integrate the team.
So is there a degree then when you say virulent? No evidence he was a virulent racist, but there was evidence of racism on the part of the team. Does it make a difference?
I think it actually does. And I'm not saying that he doesn't have to be responsible for it. I think I'm correct in quoting Howard here when he talks about the indifference to integration. I wish he were a leader on it. I wish he were Branch Rickey. What I don't have the right to do, because he wasn't Branch Rickey, is to paint him as David Duke or George Wallace.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Okay, so let's bring Howard into the conversation here. Howard, you've written a lot about the history of the Red Sox. And let's, for folks who don't know some of the background, just briefly, Red Sox formally petitioned for this name change of the street, asking that Yawkey Way go back to its original name, Jersey Street, saying that that would send a message of inclusion because of the history of racism within the Red Sox under Yawkey's leadership. So what do you say about that as someone who knows quite a bit about this history, Howard?
Well, I think that I think that there's a few issues with this. One, I don't think that anybody who knows anything about this subject could ever say definitively that Tom Yawkey ever even met Jackie Robinson or was even in close contact enough to say anything to him. To me, that's never been the issue. It's never been an issue to me whether or not Tom Yawkey used the N-word or any word on Jackie Robinson. The issue is that the Red Sox had an opportunity to be the first team to integrate in 1945 with the tryout of Jackie Robinson. The Red Sox humiliated Jackie Robinson that day in April of 1945, and instead of being the first team to integrate, they became the last 14 years later. In between that, they were sued on numerous occasions by the, you know, by MCAD, Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, for not only not having any black ball players in the 1950s, but not having any black employees. Had it ended there, I don't think we'd be talking about this issue at all, as the Reverend knows. Everybody in Major League Baseball and in culture in general was racist back then. The Red Sox were no different from the Phillies, who were the second-to-last team to integrate, or the Tigers, who were the second-to-last American League team to integrate. The problem was that even after that, you add busing into it, and then you add the fact that black ballplayers had very difficult experiences in Boston, and then you add to it also the fact that the Red Sox did not even sign a black free agent until the 90s, until 1992. That's where the reputation comes from. Hmm. It's a taint that has lasted for a half a century or more. That's been the real issue.
So, Reverend Hammond, does the team have to reconcile with some of this nasty past?
Absolutely, as does the city of Boston.
Hmm.
I mean, as we all know, the first black reporter at the Globe was, I think, 1973.
And the Boston Herald didn't have a black sports columnist until me in 2002.
Absolutely. And so I'm not disagreeing that this city has a major problem.
Hmm.
But the city's problem isn't going to be changed, and our progress is not going to be secured by taking Tom Yawkey's name off of the Yawkey Way.
Hmm.
I actually tend to agree with that, and I could throw one quick thing in here, mm-hmm. not to switch gears on you too much. It's your show. But the issue that I have with a lot of this is that I don't necessarily believe it's a racial issue nearly as much. I do believe that John Henry and the Red Sox are sincere in the fact that they don't want to be tainted with the same Yawkey brush, that they want a new history, that they don't want this to follow them. However, they can't control history just by changing the name of a street. I think that if there's one thing about this that makes sense to me from a business standpoint, it's that Tom Yawkey owned the Red Sox for 33 years, 1933 until his death in 1976. And the Yawkey Trust owned it for the next, you know, 20 years until the Henry Group took over. And the Yawkey name is so enormous in the city of Boston, mm-hmm. and it's so synonymous with the Red Sox. I understand at some level John Henry's desire to pull out from outside of that name, to get away from the kids' table. They've had the team for 16 years. They've won 3 championships. They really have, in a lot of ways, changed the direction and the course and the attitude of the way people view the Red Sox. So even if you took race out of it, I could see why they might want something to stand on their own. I get that part.
Mm-hmm. So, Reverend Hammond, what do you say? Why can't the Red Sox sort of, step out of this Yawkey shadow and put a new stamp on themselves by doing it with a different street name?
I have no problem with them stepping outside of the Yawkey shadow. Then make your petition. We'd like the name changed because we want to step out of the Yawkey shadow. do not advance it on the basis that somehow we're going to advance racial progress in Boston, because that's not what you're going to do. You're going to increase racial division. You're going to cause a whole series of questions about many other buildings and, in fact, the work of the Yawkey Foundation.
I want to just get a little voice of the Red Sox in here. It's actually a voice of David Friedman, who's representing the Sox. And this is what he told that Boston panel today, the Public Improvement Commission. This is what he said at the hearing earlier today. Let's listen.
The undeniable and regrettable history of the Red Sox with regards to race and integration during the Yawkey stewardship make it difficult to continue to give prominence to a symbol associated with an era marred by racial discrimination and inequality.
So that was David Friedman, who's representing the Red Sox. And I'd like to ask both of you, I mean, why not take this symbolic step forward? And do you, in a way, discount these claims that this is being done because there are concerns about racial discrimination in the Red Sox? Reverend Hammond.
I never tried to figure out people's motivations. Mm-hmm. What I can say is if you're really serious, and you can go look at the Globe series on the things we need to do in this city mm-hmm. and the issues that I'm facing for people who live here and young people trying to grow up and find opportunity and equity here, name changes are not what we need. We'd love to sit down with the Red Sox and make a real difference for this city and for its young people. But a name change isn't going to get us there.
But aren't we at a time where we're seeing statues and different things that we may have commemorated in another time come down now because we're at a different place culturally?
No, I agree with taking down a statue that was erected to intimidate people. I'm not taking down the Lincoln Monument because Lincoln didn't necessarily think blacks should have all rights. I'm not necessarily in favor of changing the Washington Street because Washington was a slave owner. I think we have to look at our history and learn from it and then move forward.
Scrub it. Mm-hmm. You can't scrub it clean just by making, by making the name change. And I'll throw a couple of things at you as well on this. I think, number one, let's not forget that history is a moving river. It's a document. It keeps going. And the Red Sox, for all we talk about, the Red Sox are as white now as they were in terms of their front offices. They're one of the whitest front offices in baseball. So
Absolutely.
When you're talking about opportunity and such, they could hire a few more people, and that would make a big difference as well. Alex Cora is their first minority manager in the 117-year history of that team. So there's, you know, there are other things you can do. But I also agree with the Red Sox on one hand. What they're also saying in some level is it's getting hard for us to do business. We believe it's hard for us to do business. We always have to answer for the Yawkey name. Every single time somebody brings up the Red Sox and they bring up our street, they bring up Yawkey. And I think the question is, do the Red Sox have a right, or as a business, to decouple from parts of their past that they want to be decoupled from? They don't want the Yawkey name necessarily on their stationery anymore. They don't want it to define them in a way that history has defined them. So I think, to me, the question is the Yawkey name synonymous with the Red Sox in a way that's bigger than the current ownership? And let's not forget, that name is all over the city. It's on the subway stop across the street from Fenway Park. It's on the hospitals. Yeah. It's everywhere. And if you really do look at what that Yawkey Foundation has done in terms of raw dollars, they've paid their own price, and they've tried to back it up with some money as well. And let's face it, money does matter. Hmm.
So, Reverend Hammond, do the Red Sox have a right to decouple from the Yawkey name?
They certainly have a right to petition for it. I don't think that they have a right, again, to tarnish another man's legacy. Right. And last thing I would say is I don't think they have the right to mire Boston in its ongoing politics of symbolism and history of recrimination and revenge when, in fact, we could be moving forward to really address our problems.
What would be another way? Can you think of another way? Either of you, Howard, I'd like to ask you both this. What would be another way for them to be able to do this, to step away and say that they're making some kind of a change here?
Well, I think that whenever someone has asked me, and I think one of the most insulting to me as an African-American questions that I've ever had, especially as a Bostonian, has been, was Tom Yawkey or was Tom Yawkey not a racist? I don't know. I don't care. He was dead when I was 7 years old. To me, the issue has always been the product you put on the field and the business that you run. And the business that the Red Sox have run was far more racist than anything that you could possibly say about Tom Yawkey. So to me, the answer is run a better business, do a better job being inclusive, make Fenway Park a place where Adam Jones doesn't feel like he's the subject of racial slurs and everything else. There are plenty of things you can do. Personally, I feel if you really want to just do something different, name it after Pedro Martinez. If you really want a street name that makes it, you know, that makes it inclusive of everybody, name it after Ted Williams, although he already has a street. Do something if you feel you really, really need to. But is this the fight you want to fight? I'm not really sure it is. I'm not a big fan of scrubbing history.
Reverend Hammond, what happens next in terms of the commission taking up the Red Sox request to rename
it? It's very much in their hands. There's another hearing on the 29th. More people will come to present their viewpoint. Frankly, in the meantime, again, I'm hoping that we can find some way for the Red Sox and the Yawkey Foundation to sit down and talk about what we do to move the city forward, and especially its young people, rather than relitigating the past.
All right. Reverend Ray Hammond, trustee at the Yawkey Foundation, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Howard Bryant, writer for ESPN and author of the book Shut Out, A Story of Race in Baseball in Boston. Howard, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for being here, Howard.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. In the age of Me Too, a new workshop is exploring sexual harassment through Shakespeare. The workshop, titled And Speak I Will, delves into the themes of three of the Bard's plays, which, of course, were written long before we even heard the word hashtag. The workshop is led by Tina Packer, who's founding artistic director of Shakespeare & Company. She's currently the Kunkemüller Artist in Residence at Boston Conservatory at Berkeley, and she joins us in the studio to talk about this. Tina Packer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you.
So Shakespeare is known for a long study, right, of male-female relationships and the battle of the sexes many times. What do you hope to do with this workshop?
Well, really, just as we look at this whole thing of sexual harassment, look at the depth of it, look how long it's been going on for, look at where the history comes from, and because Shakespeare records human experience, it's all the way through the plays. I mean, not just the three that we've chosen, but, you know, almost any play, there's somewhere, something about some person in power hitting on usually a woman, but occasionally a man, usually so in a way that they don't want. And so I think to have that perspective, and I think, Deb, also when you're dealing with a great artist dealing with this thing, you can go into the nastiness of it and actually come out wholer than you went in. So that the poetry or the creative energy allows you to be healthier after you've been into it than when you went. Once you come out the other side, it's a healthier state.
So that's why you're doing it.
Yeah, well, So
let's talk about the three plays in your workshop.
Yeah.
So first, Measure for Measure.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
This is one of Shakespeare's earliest, maybe the earliest.
No, that's Taming of the Shrew, that's the earliest.
Oh.
This is a later one.
Okay.
And he was writing about what happens when the church takes over the laws of the land. So very topical, very topical.
Right.
And does the conceptualization of what God says should be true, does that make good law? And, of course, the Puritans were taking over the city of London at the time Shakespeare was writing this, and they were stopping bear baiting and cockfighting. They were closing down all the brothels and the playhouses. So it touched Shakespeare very dearly, this particular topic. And, of course, this was the great upheaval. And where does sexuality go when the church says no sex before marriage, and in this case you're going to get killed if you do, or nobody having, you know, being able to do brothels or anything like that? When, of course, those Puritans then came over here after that struggle had, I mean, I don't mean that it wasn't also in England, but by and large that Puritan thinking came to Boston and the city on the hill. And so I felt it was important for us to do Measure for Measure. measure, because in fact that's that streak of authoritarianism actually landed up in Boston. So as I'm a good American citizen, I felt that we should do it.
You know, we actually have a clip from Measure for Measure from a 1997 BBC documentary, Conjuring Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And we should tell a little bit about the story here. So a woman's about to enter a convent, right?
Yes.
Isabella. Yeah. Her brother's been arrested and sentenced to death.
Yes, for having sex before marriage.
For having sex.
As Shakespeare himself did, by the way.
And she goes to a deputy,
yes,
or sheriff, as we might call someone like that now, Angelo,
saying,
please don't kill my brother. And Angelo says, well, if you sleep with me,
maybe
I'll spare your brother, right? So here in this clip, David Tennant is playing Angelo, and Catherine Cusack is Isabella, and Angelo has just made his proposal, right, for her brother's life, and he tries to force himself on Isabella, and she threatens to go public. Let's listen.
Yeah. I will proclaim thee, Angelo. Look for it. Sign me a present pardon for my brother, or with an outstretched throat I'll tell the world aloud what man thou art.
Who will believe thee, Isabel? My unsoiled name, the austereness of my life, my vouch against you and my place of the state will so your accusation overweigh that you will stifle up in your own report and smell of calumny.
Hmm, who will believe you, Isabel?
Yeah, very, isn't it? Powerful.
Yeah. I mean, we hear that all the time now. Was that also a reason why?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in fact, if you just look at the Harvey Weinstein case, you see how many, 80 women, how many women were there before there were actually enough to say, we're going to sue you? And how many women year after year maybe said something about it and nobody did anything about it because he was more powerful. And anyway, everybody wanted jobs with him. So you shut up, you know, and we won't even start on the president.
But, you know, there's a part in Measure for Measure that also talks about Isabella's anger, right?
Yeah.
And her rage.
Absolutely.
And how you can go too far when you look at the world in such black and white. And so did you want to get at that as well?
Well, I am trying to get at that because I don't know what the answer is. And I don't know if you know what the answer is. But what kind of structure, because we have to have structures in order to live together. On the other hand, if you make rigid laws that can't be broken, what does that do to human relationships? You know, how do you have the nuance of sexual attraction, sexual approach? You know, what is that? And that's such an individual thing. So when clearly, I think you should not be able to harass people. But there's a huge area between what looks like a piece of honest approach to one person and a dishonest approach to another mm-hmm. person. And the anger that women in particular feel when they've been violated and the signals have not been picked up of, no, this is not okay with me. Actually, I'm not interested. You know, it's a huge thing, and it's something we've all dealt with. It's not as if it's one in 20 women. It's not. It's every woman practically, or 9 out of 10 women.
Right.
You know, so how do you manage that, Deb? And especially in our day when everybody's on their phones all the time. There's instant information. There's dating sites everywhere. How do we manage this? Because it does have to be managed.
Yeah. And are we managing it now?
Not terribly well.
Yeah,
I think we're at least having the conversation though, which we weren't before. So we're having the conversation, and I think that Isabel's anger and rage. And in a way, she was dealing with it by going into the nunnery, so saying, I'm removing myself from the whole thing. At the end, does she come out of the nunnery or not? Shakespeare leaves it ambiguous. We don't know whether she says yes to the Duke, and then even that, you know.
Right.
So the Duke at the end says, well, actually, if you'll marry me, you know, blah, blah. And you think, what? We've gone through all this with this other bloke, and now you're coming on to it?
Now, what about The Taming of the Shrew, the other play that I thought was earlier than this? Forgive my Shakespeare history here mistake, but this is also in your workshop.
Yep.
Why?
Because I wanted, well, two things. It was totally acceptable in Shakespeare's day for a wife to tame, for, I mean, for a husband to tame his wife. There were pamphlets about it. There was advice about it. You know, you can hit her, but you can't kill her. Hmm. You know, so if she's disobedient, you can do all these things. And everything a wife owned belonged to her husband. If he died, she got a third of it so she could live until she got married again, and then it all went to her new husband. Now, that law was in practice then, and it actually didn't come off, because I know when I got married the first time in the 60s, my husband's name went on to the house deeds, not mine. So, you know, it's been a long time. Practice this about I own you, I own everything you own. Mm-hmm. So I first of all wanted to make that clear that that's been going on for a long time. But the other thing that seemed to me that we've been telling a lie about, which Shakespeare actually, I think, was probably also telling a lie about, except because he was a great artist, he put some depth in it. You know, I will tell the anger of my heart, or else my heart concealing it will break. So he has Kate saying that. But that he actually thought it was okay for men to do this to women. But when you look at the text, how does he tame her? He starves her. He takes away her clothes. He won't let her say what she wants to say. He won't let her go where she wants to go. And so she ends up acquiescing and doing what he wants. And of course, if you play it as in the traditional style, everybody's happy ever after, except you and I know that those women would all be on tranquilizers today. You know, if you weren't allowed to read what you wanted, say what you wanted, you know, you would, or you'd have gone to baby doll cuteness like Marilyn Monroe and just, he's so lovely. So you avoid the whole issue.
I love that you do voices while we're talking. But, you know, I've heard some argue that actually it's a love story and Taming of the Shrew.
That's how we make it acceptable. But why, if it's a true love story, wouldn't there be 50-50 here? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't she be allowed to say what she wants and he be allowed to say what he wants, and they'd work it backwards and forwards? Mm-hmm. Why does she have to say exactly that the sun is the moon and the moon is the sun? So he's very clear. Say as I say, or we will never go. So he's really clear that she's got to say as he says. If it were true love, Deb, they would be negotiating their relationship, and both of them would want to be whole human beings.
They would. Well, I don't want to argue about that with you, certainly, Andrea, but I have read that before. Was Shakespeare a misogynist?
I think he was at that point, because he's right in the beginning of his career and is looking at what's going to make a good story and what's going to sell. But no, by the time he gets to the end of his life, he's saying, for God's sake, follow the women. For God's sake, do what the women say we should be doing, or at least negotiate women's ways of knowing. Because, I mean, the very last thing he wrote about anybody was the baby Elizabeth in Henry VIII, and it's all about goodness grows with her. Mm. Truth will be spoken in her day. It's a eulogy to the feminine spirit. And so, no, by the time he finished, he actually knew the power of women, and both how, if they were thwarted, how destructive they could be, but also how enlightened they are. And you know, the other play, if I can go to it just for a moment, which is Troilus and Cressida, is a play about men perpetually at war and what does it do to them. And if they live by an honor culture, women don't really have a place in that except as objects of fantasy. And in fact, if you take your wife's advice, that's shaming and dishonorable. And so all the women's voices in Troilus and Cressida are shut up. And it destroys love again. So it's and then there's a kind of collective gang rape in Troilus and Cressida. So that was another reason I thought that we should put it in, because it's you know, and the idea is she's as false as Cressida and he's as true as Troilus. But if you look at it, he's the one who's untrue to her because he doesn't defend her. He doesn't stand up for her. He doesn't say, no, she can't go over to the Greek side. She's my wife. you know, and because he's secretly kind of married her. And so he doesn't defend her, and she's left to fend for herself, and she totally crumbles in the face of it. So for me, he's as false as Troilus, and she's as true as Cressid.
Aren't you concerned by going all the way back to use these old plays that in a way you're saying, this has been going on forever?
I do, and it has been going on forever, and I think it's important. I mean, you know, Zeus, this is 3000 when BC, Zeus was accused of raping women, you know, and so that's the earliest of our Western culture ideas. So it's always been acceptable. So it's a huge, huge task we have, huge. And so I hope by going back, we can put it into some perspective and the courage of women now to actually stand up for themselves and say, let's look at it differently. And how can we have whole human beings? And it's not just men and women. It's the whole gender fluidity. It's the whole way in which we look at our sexuality, which is up for grabs. Oh, well, that's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? it's the whole of the way in which we look at sexuality that needs to be re-examined. And it's going to take 50 years or something. But we've got to do it because women need to live whole lives.
What are you hearing from the students about what they're going to bring forward to this?
Well, these students come from the Contemporary Theatre Division of Boston Conservatory. So they've been working on a lot of devised pieces. So they create their own theatre. This is their first classical foray. And so I think at first they wondered what it had to do with them. Then as we actually started getting into the depth of the text, then they definitely start. I mean, just the bit that you quoted, you know, to whom should I complain? Did I tell this? Who would believe me? Suddenly felt very here and now to them. And the idea of what the function of theatre is. It's actually to say the things that can't be spoken so that we can examine them without actually having to, so you can look at the experience of it without having to go through the trauma of the thing itself. They really clocked onto that. They really said, yes, this is something that we can use, we can understand as we look at ourselves, our own lives, and then have some language to say it in, because Shakespeare is a great wordsmith, so there's great language to say it with.
All right. Well, Tina Packer, founding artistic director of Shakespeare and Company. She's currently the Kunkka-Müller Artist in Residence at the Boston Conservatory at Berkeley. She'll be presenting the workshop And Speak I Will at the Boston Center for the Arts tonight through Saturday. We'll have more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Tina, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, the new movie about the continuing mystery surrounding the late Ted Kennedy and the accident on Chappaquiddick. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Chappaquiddick. That one-word name of the remote, occasional island area of Martha's Vineyard makes many people immediately think of the scandal that cost the late Senator Ted Kennedy the White House. Almost 49 years ago, Kennedy said he accidentally drove his car off a bridge on Chappaquiddick, causing the death of his young female passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne. In the years since, there have been several books and investigations into the questions still surrounding that crash and why it took Kennedy so long to go to the police. The latest look at what happened is in the new movie titled Chappaquiddick, where Kennedy is played by Jason Clarke.
It was an accident, and, well, one of Bobby's secretaries is dead. I was driving. No one else was involved. I'm okay. Maybe that's too much to drink. I just don't know. I need your help, Dad. Need it.
The film Chappaquiddick opens at the Martha's Vineyard Film Festival tonight before a general release in April. Joining me to talk about the incident and the Kennedy legacy is Thomas Whalen. He is Associate Professor of Social Sciences at Boston University and the author of two books on JFK and the Kennedy family. Hello, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So let's, in case some folks don't remember, 49 years ago was a long time. So July 18th, 1969, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy said he was at a cookout. He left with Mary Jo Kopechne, a woman who had worked on the presidential campaign of his brother Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Ted Kennedy said later that he took too sharp a turn while he was driving his car over a small wooden bridge. The car overturned. It submerged in a pond. And then Kennedy said he was unable to retrieve Mary Jo Kopechne from that car. It was about 10 hours, apparently, before mm-hmm. he reported it to police. If that happened today, Tom Whalen, do you think a senator would face legal consequences, involuntary manslaughter or something like that?
Oh, I think so. I think his political career would have been over, and he'd be subject to all sorts of scrutiny. I mean, basically, you're talking about the local district attorney, the state attorney general, turning the other way in what was, I believe, a criminal act.
Mm-hmm. But this movie suggests that there, you know, was quite a bit of turning the other way on the part of lots of people, from the U.S. attorney in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. The police, all kinds of folks sort of turning the other way, allowing him to plead early to only charges of leaving the scene of an accident and things like that. Is it because there was a political dynasty in the Kennedy family and those dynasties no longer exist today? Or what do you think would be different now?
I think we have changed as a society that, you know, the Kennedys are the same, but, you know, standards, expectations, values have changed. I mean, in many ways, Ted Kennedy embodies the old misogynistic ideal of the male politician in American politics. Mm. You know, the Kennedys were known for ruthlessly exploiting women, discarding them with an alarming regularity and just, you know, doing all sorts of awful things. And the family took its cue from the patriarch, Joseph P. Kennedy. You know, his daughters would bring home their friends and, you know, Joseph P. Kennedy at night would creep into their bedrooms and try to have his way with them. And, you know, the children, the Kennedy children, didn't seem to have any qualms with that. This seemed to be the norm within the family. It was extremely dysfunctional. But, you know, today, if you try that, I mean, my goodness, the wrath of all society would fall upon you. But it shows, especially now in the last 6 months, you know, with the Me Too movement, history has changed. Our society has changed in a way that is for the better. Mm.
But I wonder because, you know, the movie also alludes to this sort of real belief in what the Kennedys could do politically. Mm-hmm. There were people who really believed in what was going on with Teddy, with John Kennedy, Bobby, right? And certainly over the years I've interviewed people who really believed that they could affect change and make the country better. And they were willing to overlook whatever personal failings they felt that person had mm-hmm. because of what they expected to achieve politically. Aren't we sort of seeing that today with President Trump? And there are people still willing to do that. Is it just a different kind of cult, maybe?
It's different in the sense that really Chappaquiddick, you could say, represents the end of the 1960s. This 1960s begins with John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, you know, soaring rhetoric, you know, ask not what your country can do for you. But it ends basically at that bridge in Chappaquiddick. And all the idealism of the 60s, all the hopes seem to go down with that car and the life of Mary Jo Kopechne. That, you know, it's a symbol for the age. But today, I mean, I think Trump in the, you know, the expanse of history will be seen more of as an aberration.
You think so?
I think so. I mean, basically, you know, look at the way the country is changing. Look at the fact that we're even having this conversation. We would not have this conversation in the 1960s or the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. Trump was he was an accidental president. You know, Ted Kennedy really was representative truly of his times and of his family and their political dynasty.
Does it suggest that even the fact that this movie has come out, that maybe there's a real change in for the Kennedy family legacy?
Well, absolutely. And I think it's going to not be for the good that the Kennedys are, in a sense, a spent political dynasty, that I think the country and the world is moving beyond that. I mean, if you look at, say, the attendance figures at the Edward Kennedy Museum at Columbia Point, which is right next to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Museum, mm-hmm. they're having a lot of trouble drawing numbers there. But you can understand why. I mean, Ted Kennedy is a very problematic historical figure.
Still called the Lion of the Senate. Still many people say he did good work politically. Do you think that those 49-year-old personal scandals really influence people's decision as to whether they're going to go?
Well, I think if you are below 40, yes, it does. If you ask, you know, I've asked my students in my classes, you know, who are, just came of age this past decade, and they think Ted Kennedy, you know, their image of him as an alcoholic, as someone who is a womanizer, a misogynist, and they want nothing to do with him. And I think it's a generational thing. If you're above the age of 40, because of what the Kennedys represented in kind of an idealistic sense, you'll get a different answer.
I want to play a clip of the speech mm-hmm. that Senator Kennedy made. And it was really a remarkable televised statement the day he pleaded guilty to leaving the scene of an accident charges. Part of this speech was in the movie, but this is some of the original speech. Let's listen.
And so I ask you tonight, the people of Massachusetts, to think this through with me. In facing this decision, I seek your advice and opinion. In making it, I seek your prayers. For this is a decision that I will have finally to make on my own.
So it's about a 14-minute statement on the part of a senator saying, I am seeking your advice as to whether I should stay in office. Now, I know we heard from one columnist who said watching this was giving flashbacks of President Trump talking to the camera after the release of the Access Hollywood tape. So, again, similarities there. And we're told the White House is screening this movie. So what's the lesson to take from how that was handled politically? Is there one? Or would it be completely different again today because we're at a different time?
It's different times. And, you know, that I listen to that and I just cringe. It's just like a portrait of narcissism because nowhere in that statement is mentioned Mary Jo Kopechne. A person has died due to your negligence. Mm. And all you can care about is the future of your political career. It's just utterly shameful.
Well, it was my understanding that Mary Jo Kopechne's parents and others felt that this was an accident and weren't, and at least initially, weren't very critical of Ted Kennedy for this. So if her loved ones weren't and they felt that this was an accident, I'm just curious about what you think about that.
Well, I think, again, it goes back to that aura of the Kennedy name that, you know, of course it has to be an accident. It can't be due to their negligence. These are the Kennedys, after all. They are America's family. But then, you know, when you stop and think about it and you stare at reality in the face, you can see that, well, there is a lot of questions that can be asked here. And the Kennedy family seems to, if not answering it, they seem to be covering up the truth. And I think that is where the disillusionment, that's really the true end of Camelot as we know it in a political sense.
Hmm. We hear a lot about Joe Kennedy III. Mm-hmm. You know, he gave the Democratic response, certainly, to the president's speech this year. And folks are talking about him as perhaps carrying on the Kennedy family legacy.
Well, I see the ceiling for him as perhaps, you know, succeeding Ed Markey for the United States Senate. But there's no way I think he's anywhere close to being presidential timber.
Hmm.
Maybe 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, that Democratic response the other, you know, last month where it looks like he was drooling the Vaseline or the chapstick that he applied to his face. But I thought about that and, like, think about the old Kennedy dynasty. They would have an army of people, television experts, you know, to put on makeup and make everything look perfect. The new generation doesn't think of those details. And it shows to me how the dynasty is slowly dying out. That, you know, the old Kennedys, you know, they had the power of Wall Street and Hollywood behind them. This new generation does not.
But in the movie, it does show that, too. We should mention that in the movie when Ted Kennedy is trying to figure out a public relations strategy, mm-hmm. he does go to a bunch of advisors, mostly advisors of his father's, and asks them how to handle this legally. Sometimes he doesn't listen to them. And when he does doesn't listen to those advisors. It's made clear that he made a mistake by not listening to them. But does it mean then that it's such a different political system that those advisors are no longer necessary, or is it that the Kennedys no longer have those advisors? Which is it?
I think it's both. I mean, the Kennedys don't have those kind of advisors, or if they those advisors are so old and out of touch that they're irrelevant. They weren't able to replace those initial advisors. The Kennedys are not cutting edge. They are a nostalgia band. That's what they are.
Is there any sort of power family in this country then at all anymore?
Well, I think that's what's interesting here at the millennium, that, you know, with Trump's victory, he's kind of swept aside the Bush dynasty, which was the only one close to the Kennedys in terms of popularity and power projected here. But I think political dynasties are anti-democratic. I think it's a healthy thing that we don't have political dynasties.
All right. Tom Whalen, Associate Professor of Social Sciences at Boston University, author of two books about the Kennedys. The film Chappaquiddick opens at the Martha's Vineyard Film Festival tonight before a general release in April. Professor Whalen, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.